G'day and Happy New Year from me, Cassie McCullough. I hope the head's okay. Thanks for tuning in to Best of the Festivals on this first day of 2016. Today, musician turned novelist John Darnielle in conversation with The Chasers' Julian Morrow. Well known as frontman of indie pop band The Mountain Goats, John released his first book recently, a work of fiction called Wolf in White Van. In it, an isolated man called Sean Phillips orchestrates Trace Italian, a role-playing game that imagines a ravaged America of the future. But disaster strikes when two players take the game into the real world and Sean is called to account. The central character is drawn back through time to confront the disfiguring injuries that changed his life as a 17-year-old. Sounds complicated. Here's John.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome, John. It's a great pleasure to have you here. And,
thank you.
And look, I assume, you know, now that you're a serious literary novelist, yes. It must be a thrill for you to be doing an event like this where there's like a live audience, not at home, but like a live audience of people who won't cheer or dance at any point,
you
scream
never know
your
if
name.
They will or not. You
yeah, they'll just appreciate your literary qualities. It's great.
So, no, it's the readings have been
feel
very
free to crowd surf at any point during the show. Yeah. Now, some of you may be aware that John has dabbled in a few other forms of creative expression before.
For example, painting.
Yeah, painting, yeah. So I wanted to ask you to begin with how Wolf in White Van came about. Was it the idea of writing a novel that you were playing with and decided to commit to? Or was there an idea that became a story longer than you imagined?
No, it's a lot faster than that. I don't really think about the work I'm going to do before I do it. I just start doing stuff, right? And that's always been, that's when my stuff started to get good, when I stopped saying, well, now I will write a song. And it's like, no, I just start playing and ad-libbing out loud, and a song happens, right? And so I had handed in Master of Reality, which was this novella that I wrote beforehand. It was a kind of a work of musical criticism masquerading as a novel, And I handed it in, really enjoyed the process of that, especially like the last day of getting the manuscript together before I turned it in was really just this fury. It was like handing in your senior thesis or something. I'm the only guy in the world to whom that sounds like, yeah, fun, right?
So, yeah.
But to me, it was fun. It was like I was at a friend's house. I woke up still throwing parts together, and I was done. I came back from New York, and this thing I'd been working on for the better part of a year was off my table, right? And so I woke up and flipped open the laptop, and that wasn't on my schedule anymore, so I started writing something else, which became the last chapter of Wolf in White Van. And it was just a little story that took place in Southern California during the mid-80s, which is when I went to high school, and with a bunch of people who resembled the sorts of people... This is going to be long. So my high school had about 900 people in it, and as in high school, they divide up into cliques, and... there were the ones who went up to the park to smoke cigarettes, right? The high school wouldn't hassle you if you crossed the parking lot and hung out on the bleachers smoking cigarettes. Most of them were big heavy metal fans. I was a smoker, so I went and hung out with those guys, right? But I wasn't quite of their number, but I would listen to them talk. And those became the five friends who Sean hangs out with in that last chapter. So I was just writing a scene to try and capture the mood of this crossing the high school parking lot to stand there and smoke cigarettes and sort of feel sophisticated in a dirty sort of way, and I wrote that, and when the chapter, it sort of clicked right along, and then this thing happens that happens at the end of the book. I didn't want it to be a short story like that, so I thought, what could happen next? And then that was the next 4 or 5 years of my life.
And so given that process, at what point do you know it's a novel? Are you worried that at some point it'll never end, that you're just going to keep writing it?
Now, to me, that would be really satisfying. Right, it's like probably not as satisfying as how nice the book has done, but at the same time, I like the idea of an unreachable grail. You know, it's like I just love, you know, like I thought about it several times when
so
I.
So you haven't planned out the trilogy and the prequels?
No. I don't believe in sequels. The initial draft after that happened, I didn't know where to go from there. So there were all these other chapters that were written by other people, right, by his father. The one by his father winds up, I folded into the opening scene of the book, but that was originally written from the point of view of the father carrying his son down the hall. And then there was a chapter by a preacher who the parents call to talk to, no, who stops by because he's heard about the accident and he hopes to use Sean's disfigurement for his purposes, right? And there were chapters by everybody, right? And I did this for a couple years. I was doing other stuff. I was making albums and touring and stuff, but I would work on this thing when I got a chance on, you know, international flights or wherever, in hotel rooms. And at one point, I looked at all that stuff, and I went, well, I'm glad to know all these people, but that's not the actual book. And I dragged all those files into a separate folder that said, like, previous, right, and started over. And that's when I got the idea to tell it backwards from that last chapter.
Wow.
So, I mean, all that was like character development and study. You know how I was saying this today, is like, you know how painters will do sketches in charcoal of the thing they're going to draw. We don't usually do that in music. We used to when the music business had more money flowing around. People would do what was called pre-production, where they would go in and record versions of the songs, right, to see how they're going to approach recording it. What are they going to, who will track together, what might sound good on it. And then you'd throw, you know, a kazoo on and see what it sounded like in pre-production. And then when you were actually in the bigger studio, that's when you would go ahead and do all the stuff you'd learned. And that was kind of like a pre-production phase.
The novel is, you know, admirably kazoo-free. It's good on that.
There's
score.
A hidden kazoo, if you recall.
That's fascinating as a process, though, because, I mean, knowing your lyrics, I can well imagine that you could conjure up the perspective of all sorts of different characters that we don't actually see from their perspective
in
the novel. What do you think it is about you as a writer that makes you go, actually, you know what, this is all pre-production. This is a different thing.
Well, no, I didn't do it while I was doing it. That's the thing. For one thing, I always focus on what's directly in front of me, you know, and so I wasn't thinking about where it was going to go, and I didn't have an agent or a publisher lined up. I was doing a thing, you know, and that for me, I do all my best work, you know. I wrote the song No Children on an Airplane, right? And it was.
It is my favorite song of yours.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
I did not know that, but well, then you might like the story. So it was a joke, right? There was a song playing on the radio that I disliked called I Hope You Dance, right? And I made the joke that becomes the chorus of the song. As I was driving to the airport, I went, God, that's funny. That is funny, right? And I got on the airplane. I started writing it on the little sleeve that holds your ticket, right? And then when I landed, you know, visited with some people. They dropped me off at a hotel room, and I worked some more on it, and I put it away for a couple of days. But I never think about what I'm doing past the actual thing. I don't think what's it going to become or what's it for, you know. And so when I was doing all that stuff, I was just doing a thing that maybe would become a thing, and maybe, I mean, my notebooks are full of the stuff that doesn't go anywhere, right, and that isn't any good because it didn't get hammered into shape. So.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously, you treat the process as very organic, and you're there in the moment. Can you draw contrasts between the process of writing a lyric for a song, a very short form, and the sort of sprawling process of a novel? Were there things about the novel that you really enjoyed and appreciated as a sort of contrast to your songwriting, and there were other things that you just went, oh, this is really hard?
Well, the thing is, like, I've been writing songs for a long time now, but it's always been a very fast process. It's performative. I mean, that's part of what my songs are about, is that I want them to sound like I just thought of it on the spot, right? Even though they rhyme and all, kind of, I want you to still get that feeling, you know, that you know, this is just some crazed person talking feeling, you know. You got to work hard on that, but
yeah, that feeling.
But you know what I mean? It's like you want when you first see a play when you're a child and you don't know that there's a script, it seems magic, right? Mm. And so that's what I want. With a novel, it's like there's just so much more ebb and flow and a lot of freedom. When a song starts to go in a certain direction, it's like chasing a train. You just have to follow it where it's going. Whereas you have, you know, when you're writing a novel, you have a lot of power. You can, you know, when you realize you're going to kill somebody, you know, it's like most... Also, dramatic things like that tend not to happen in songs unless that's what the song is about. Mm. Like a character doesn't die in the first verse, right? Because then you have to figure out why there's two more verses and a bridge. But in a book, you like can suddenly go, what if he's dead? What if he dies now? Right? And then you can write three or four chapters with that and decide you don't like the idea. But then that guy always sort of has the stain of death on him thereafter, you know, and stuff like that. there's just a lot more freedom in a novel. A song is a performance, essentially, for me, you know, and I write them with a view to performing them live because I think that's where music lives, you know, is in front of people. And so, yeah. But, I mean, songs are so much more familiar to me that it's very hard to compare. It's like, there's a writer named Harlan Ellison who used to write in front of, he would write in a store to help the store sell books and stuff. He would, like, write a story in a day. I could do that with a song, but I couldn't do that with a novel. I have to have time by myself. I have to get up and pace. I have to read the thing out loud, you know.
So, as a person adept in creating in both those fields, how do you know whether you, I mean, have you got another album brewing or a novel, or do you do both? Or, like, because they sound like very different processes.
They're different, but they're not. They come from the same place. Yeah. Like, it just sort of depends on what you feel like doing. If you are working on a novel, it's nice because then, you know, then you can say, well, what do I have to do this morning? Well, I'm not done with the novel yet, right? Whereas with a song, you sort of wait until you have an idea or you happen to be idly playing with a guitar and something comes out and then you do that. But yeah, I mean, the way that I write songs is I'm playing guitar first. So if I have a guitar in my hand, then there's a good chance I'm going to write a song. Whereas with prose, you sit down and you open up the program and you decide to do it, right? It's like, it's a little more willful.
You talked about how you sort of conceived that crucial last scene as one thing. How much of Sean's predicament was there in that moment?
Like, I had no idea. Right. It's like, this is the thing, it's like when I wrote that, the last sentence that isn't there anymore, it was different then, but the same thing happened, and I was like, well, you know, when you are a young writer writing short stories when you're 13 or 14, people tend to die at the end of the story. This just happens, right? And you go, and it's a young writer thing. It's like you end it with either people wake up and it was a dream, or everybody dies. Right? And so this thing happened, but I was like, okay, well, that's not, now you have a character and a thing. What else could happen besides the guy dying, right? And I started asking questions about that. And this is the thing, is like, this is the other thing. When you write a song, you're sort of saying something, even if it's only to describe something or to point at something, you know, illuminate a little something. But when you write a bigger book, you're just asking questions. You know, it's like you're not really, I don't, not that songs are didactic, but they're indicative, right? Whereas for me, a novel isn't indicative, it's suggestive. Right?
Because one of the things that I think is really striking about the book is how suggestive Sean's predicament is. Mm. But it sounds like that's something that sort of occurred to you or settled upon you. Like you had Sean before you had his predicament.
Right. No, it arises as I do it. It's part of the, it arises in the process. I did a little bit of outlining, but then you're always free to not do it. And the outlining I did was so vague. It was like, you know, a man goes to a park, right? That was the outline of the first chapter, right? And so, and stuff like that. I sort of trust myself to do something that I will find interesting, right? And I think I've become good enough at criticizing my own stuff that if it's not interesting, I'll either throw it away or keep hammering at it until it is.
Mm. Sounds like there's a lot of really good, really fascinating stuff that you've thrown away.
I would take a lot of pleasure in throwing stuff away. You know, not enough stuff gets thrown away.
I'm fascinated by the role of, you know, creativity expression in the book, and obviously it resonates with your role as a creative person in other fields. Trace Italian kind of becomes Sean's salvation in a way. It gives him something to really focus on. Is that a part of your view about what creative expression and art can do?
Well, I don't know, because again, the way that I write, I'm not a 19th century novelist who's choosing a vehicle through which to express an idea. Mm. I'm sort of dreaming out loud in front of people, right? And so then when you have a dream, right, you don't say, well, you know, obviously the cigar is a penis, right? You don't say,
yeah.
you say,
yeah,
you know,
we'll ask you about the cigar.
You say, well, you know, I know some people who smoke or whatever. Things can mean a number of things, and you read dreams in a bunch of different ways, and none of them are the definitive way of reading dreams, because we can't know, right, how dreams work. We can only have ideas about them. Maybe they're Freudian, but maybe they're Jungian ideas about archetypes. I had an old therapist whose way of reading a dream was everyone in the dream is you, right? Which is a great way of reading dreams.
Yeah, and a good business model.
Yeah. but it's totally true. It's like you can't have other people living in your head, right? Yeah. So they are you. They're you imagining yourself as all these characters. So when I'm writing, I'm not trying to say something. I'm telling some story, and then I look at it. And as I go, I sort of ask more questions about it and ask, well, what would happen next then? Mm. Right? But I don't say that I want to make this point about creativity. But so in this book, this is a long answer, but in this book, it was kind of undeniable that it seemed to be about a person who makes something and to some extent about a person who makes something and it gets away from him in some way, right? The separation between the creator and his creation, right? Mm. And obviously that speaks to me in some way, but I want to sort of remain a little unaware of that because for me the story loses its potency if I know entirely what it's about.
Yeah, right. That's really interesting because I suppose the other side of it is that part of, I would say a theme that you might not have consciously decided on the way in, but something that's definitely there in the book and the title, is the idea of danger and harm associated with creative expression. And you know, obviously you piercingly make fun of people who worry about lyrics played backwards and these sorts of things. And yet at the same time, you've crafted a character who, in a far more direct and seemingly causative way, has caused harm to a couple of young, innocent people.
I'm hesitating over the word cause.
Yeah, okay, all right. Strongly associated with, in a way that gives rise to a legal case.
Somebody made use of in a way that wasn't, that brought them to harm.
Yeah.
I mean, people are responsible for their own actions, right? If I write a song and somebody gets really sad about it, I wrote a song and it made somebody sad, but where it goes is not, there's a sense in which your responsibility ends at the thing you made, but then there's a bond between you and the people who make use of what you do.
Yeah.
Right? There is a bond. And I don't think, you hear a lot of people saying that there isn't such a bond, right? But I don't think that's true. I think it's there. I think that's one thing that he realizes, when he makes his statement at the hearing, that there's this connection between himself and his people who play this game. And that he understands that connection differently from they do, that there's also a gulf, right? And it's weird to have a bond and a gulf in the same breath, but it's true.
I can imagine his lawyers shitting themselves as that was said in the trial, because that's like, in a way, that opens up the possibility of causation, that there is something so close between the creator and the people who experienced it.
Do you remember we were talking about when a moment for reading from the book might arise organically back then?
I did.
So why don't I read Sean's statement?
Let's do that.
If you haven't gotten to the book, and we didn't discuss it at great length, so he makes this game, this disfigured guy makes a game that you play through the mail. It's called Trace Italian. And a couple of players from Florida, Lance and Carrie, come to harm when they decide that there must be an actual Trace Italian in Kansas, which is where the game takes place in the world. And so they go to Kansas. They're from Florida. It never snows in Florida. Winter in Florida is a joke. It's quite warm. Winter in Kansas is brutal. There's no trees to break the wind. It's cold, and you can't really be outside without proper dressing. But they go looking in the fields, and one of them, they're both hurt very badly. Their parents, or one of their parents, bring Sean to trial, or they try to. There's a hearing to see whether or not there's going to be a trial. And he insists that his lawyer, because when he talks, it's hard to understand him, that his lawyer read his statement for him. My lawyer read my statement. I wish I could read this to you myself instead of having somebody read it for me. It's not like I can't talk, but it is distracting to other people when I do. So I have written it down. I hope you both can understand. It would be an insult to you and to the memory of your daughter for me to spend too much time dwelling on who I am and what I am like as a person. I imagine your attorneys have explained to you how I got to be the way I am. I have no children of my own. I can't imagine what you are going through. I spent most of my teenage years in hospitals and physical therapy rehabs, it gets so lonely living inside your own head. Because of my face, I could not even wear headphones for listening to music. So I invented a world in the future, and I called it the Trace Italian. It was a place where I could have adventures. And when I grew up, I wanted to share those adventures with other people. I wanted specifically to share them with people like me, but I don't know any people like me. Most people like me are dead. I don't have close personal friends, but my customers are like friends to me. I share in their lives a little. To them, I am just a company, and that is fine. I live a little through them and the small things I learn about them. It makes my own life feel more interesting. I don't go to conventions to meet with them or personalize my business, and I don't answer personal mail. I don't want to be a creep. I am only here to provide a service. I have taken pride in that service, and my work has brought me pleasure over the years, and I never, ever thought anyone could possibly come to harm from it. If I had thought someone would get hurt because of Trace Italian, I would have shut it down. I would not even have started it in the first place. Lance and Carrie played the game together and did so well that I was amazed. I thought they were just two smart kids. Anybody would have predicted a great future for them both. I understand that you blame me, and I can't be angry about that, but I ask you to look at things my way, however different I am from normal people. In the end, I am just a guy trying to do his job. Trace Italian doesn't stand for anything in the real world, and I couldn't have guessed anyone would ever think otherwise. I hardly know anything about the real world. What little I do know, I got from books and movies. I did not knowingly send any young people to their deaths. I would not. I couldn't. Please understand. It is a little strange to me to be defending something that was supposed to have been a place where people could feel safe and have fun, where nothing ever really happens except inside our heads. But understand, too, that I have to defend myself and my creation that has brought pleasure to a few people over the years. The Trace is a good place. It is a place where people can go in their imaginations. That is a good thing. And while I'm sorry it went wrong for your daughter, it is not wrong by itself. By the way, and against advice of counsel, I want to say that Lance and Carrie were technically right. Of the four possibilities on the paper, the one that would have moved them in the direction they wanted to go was Forage for Roots. I don't know why I want to tell you this. I know it doesn't help my case. I just feel like I owe it to them to let you know. They were right to start digging, but they were only right to start digging in the game, not out in the real world, not in Kansas, in actual ground. I am so, so sorry.
I'm sure you all feel as I do, very grateful to hear that reading. Slightly disappointed that it couldn't go for the whole hour because it's just magnificent.
Thank you
to hear John reading his own work. But that's fascinating in a way because there are people, I don't know how many there are, but there would definitely be people who have never heard your music but would read the book and would really engage with it. It's incredibly engaging as a piece of writing. And yet, when you hear it in your voice... And when you know your music and your lyrics, it does...
It's a little better.
It sounds so much. Yeah, like...
The thing is, like, so I really believe strongly, and this is funny because I don't listen to audiobooks, the transition from poetry, which was all literature to begin with, right? It's like prose is a later thing. But the original tradition was spoken, and it was passed on. Writing comes later, right? And writing is this very bizarre thing, right? It's this way of saying, well... I want you to tell this thing you're telling me to somebody else, but I'm personally not going to do it because maybe I won't be there either. I want somebody who lives far away to hear it, so we'll do this thing and we'll write it down. That's weird. It does a weird thing to the actual writing. Now, there's some people who think we have completely transitioned out of that, but I don't think I have, right? It's like, for me, the first place it exists is on the tongue and in the ear, right? It's like, that's where it is. It's out there in the air. I mean, every page in this book, as I'm writing, it gets read out loud over and over and over again because that's how it sounds for me. It's like even I read it silently, but I hear it when I'm reading. It doesn't bypass the ear. Maybe it happens really quietly, but it's still there. So yeah, it's like that's for me. It's still a spoken art in some way.
Musician turned novelist John Darnielle on Best of the Festivals on RN Summer. He's in conversation with Julian Morrow about his book Wolf in White Van.
One of the beguiling things about the game that Sean designs is how simple it is and how pared back. It happens by post. There's very...
Right.
The amount of words that he writes compared to the universe that he creates, very, very limited.
Yeah.
Hard not to see Darnell comparisons in that. But how did you go about shaping the game, Trace Italian, and deciding what features were in it, what features were out? Why can't we, you know, when we go out this evening, buy the PlayStation version of Trace Italian?
Because this is the thing, you say, like, how do I go about designing the game? There is no game. It only exists in the book, right? Those moves, you could string them together to make a thing, but there aren't extra moves hiding in my files.
Mm.
It only exists as a thing that is posited, right? So I mean, it was pretty simple to think about. It's like, well, these people are in California and they have to get to Kansas. I have maps, right? And so and there's that thing at the end where he starts tracing all the possible ways, and then you think just how complicated it would have to be to think of all the possible ways through. But in point of fact, the moves that are there are the only moves that exist, right? They are pieces from a posited whole that I didn't envision every last move of it, just the shape, just the overall shape.
Is something analogous to that something that you've experienced in terms of the incredibly evocative music that you've produced and the way that you've impacted upon people? Have you ever been struck by the way people talk about what you've done and realize that it's actually something so far beyond what you imagined the day that it just flowed out of you?
I mean, the thing is, you try as you grow as a writer to not listen too much to praise or damnation. It's not healthy, you know, to be basking in what people think of what you do. You know, it's not healthy. But the other thing is, if you are hearing that, I'm feeling the connection, right? The profound connection that you feel when you make something that somebody else finds useful, right? That really, it's hard to talk about without sounding corny. It's like, it's a huge blessing, like, to have been of use like that. And so that's what I hear. It's like, if someone has some wide-ranging reading, I still think, wow, you took my vision and allowed it to live in you, right? That's, that means if lightning strikes me tonight, I still can say I lived a satisfying life, you know? I hope that it doesn't, though. I
just checked the weather report. It's like 20% chance max.
We're pretty good. Okay, good. Because they had a thing. What was it called? You guys don't get this here. So we have bad weather back home. My son hasn't been able to go to school in several days. He's 3. And it's really cold in the South right now. We don't know how to deal with cold in the South. It doesn't get cold, right? Up north in the Midwest, they know how to dress and how to drive on the cold roads, but in the South, everything shuts down. But even I, who lived 7 years in Iowa, have never heard of ice fog. but they had ice fog in North Carolina this morning, and I'm like, I'm missing the ice fog. I think that I'm sad about that, but deep in my heart, I'm not really sad to miss that. I'm cool just hearing about it.
Yeah,
wow. I'm thinking about other weather phenomena. Like thunder,
let's
snow,
literally talk about the weather. You've talked about how, as a creative person, the it's not that different whether you're writing a novel or a song. Have you noticed any differences in the way your audiences, who you clearly care about deeply, react to the concise, powerful impact of one song or a series of songs compared to the long, meandering, but also powerful experience of reading a novel?
Well, reading is private. Right? You do it in private, even if you're on a train, right? It's you and the page and the inside of your head, right? It's not a communal act. Whereas when I make music, even if people are listening to it at home, the connection is out there in the air, right? It's like it's a heard thing. It's an actual, you're hearing the same thing I heard when we mixed it. You know, it's like there's less mediation. And music is probably the most immediate of the arts, I think. And plus, most of that lives in clubs, right? It's like I'm making that connection in a room. We all, when something goes good, everybody can tell, right? And it's great, and it's cathartic, right? Events like this, as much fun as they are, there's no catharsis, right? There's no release. You get a little close to it in a reading, but we don't do, a show is a journey, right? You start this one thing, there's a little anticipation, you wait to get up, and then, you know, it's like being forced through a bottleneck, and then everybody, boom, it's very nice. And with reading, it's sort of like it's trying to share some experience that's a little too intimate to actually share, right? It's like that it happens across this big nebulous bridge that's hard to understand, which is part of what makes reading magic, is we don't really understand how it works, and the number of connections and points of contact it makes are too infinite to really grasp all at once.
Mm. A lot of your songs are very, you know, very, very powerful, but inherently brief portraits of a person or a couple of people in a particular situation. In the form of a novel, you have to play that out in a much longer time frame for the reader, and you know, and in the world of the novel. And I was struck by a few moments in the book where you describe, for example, the side effects, for want of a better expression, of being shot in the face. And right. Sean says, having taken a bullet to the face, I said, it was actually the way it messes with your hearing,
right?
Which is the worst thing. And then you talk about the impact of, is it Tegretol?
Tegretol.
Is that something that you, like, researched and looked into in the process of writing the novel, or is that all also part of your sort of creative flow?
Well, no, I used to be a nurse, right? And so Tegretol is something I passed a lot of, right? And so everybody got Tegretol in this one long-term unit I worked on, everybody. And so when he says pale pink Tegretol, it's because I used to see these pills, and, oh, these are pretty, you know, and so they were kind of pretty. but so that's just something from, you know, a lot of that medication stuff. I had to look some of it back up, and then I was just beating myself up about it because, you know, when I was a nurse, I wanted to be a big hotshot and have all this stuff in my head at all times. And you meet these nurses who forget about it because you have the reference right there. Yeah, well, I happen to have it ready from memory in case the doctor should come in and quiz me, you know, which never happens. But yeah, so that's where that stuff is from. Most of the ephemera in it was stuff I didn't need to research a lot. Was stuff I have to hand, right? At Conan, the stuff I remember, you know.
Obviously, Sean's predicament is an extreme example of self-harm.
Mm.
I'm interested in your perspective on self-harm.
I'm sitting here debating within myself, like how there's stuff in there that can get really uncomfortable. I don't want to make people uncomfortable. But when I was a teenager, the situation in my home was really dark and difficult. And I got really into self-mutilation. I carried a razor in my wallet, right? And whenever things would get really hairy inside my brain, I would open up a place on my skin, right? And I discovered that, and this was like a side knowledge piece. Like I was doing it because I could feel better afterwards, you know? And it was a period in my life. This is the thing. I think the book is in some way in reference to this because, like, as a nurse, I would hear other nurses talk about behaviors as though they were terminal, right? As though a person who has started doing this or that will do that forever. And I know, because I'm living proof, that that's not true. You go through times in your life when you are a certain way, right? And maybe it's an ugly way, right? Maybe it's a way that you yourself don't like and you can't see a way free of. But life is long, and there's a lot of ways to be. And you go through many transitions, right? And so... But that was a thing that I did. And then one day I turned around and I wasn't doing it anymore. I just had lost its appeal, right? It didn't seem like a way for me to release tension or pain. And I mean, that's a perspective I have on it. But then I worked in hospitals for a long time and I see as many other perspectives as there are people. I mean, the thing is, like, this is where I have difficulty with most treatment modalities for people who struggle with anxiety or depression or anything. It's like there are as many ways of dealing with those problems as there are people who have them, right? When we try to generalize about them, we do no favors to the people who have these problems. It's like in an ideal society, we would treat people's problems as occurring once only in one person, right? For obvious practical reasons, that's not possible, but it's what we should be thinking about, you know.
It's fascinating in that context to think about the role of carers in the novel. Like, at some points, there's a certain sort of jaded or resentful feeling. People trying to help you when you're past help, and a roar and helpless. Nobody wins. You get nothing. They feel worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's one aspect of it. But at the same time, the people who really resonate in the novel are
the caretakers?
Genuine caretakers. People who at some level have seen past the really uncomfortable tragedy of a predicament and do a service. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
That's an interesting observation, because I love Vicky, the nurse, right? Mm. I think she's a quiet caretaker, but there is also the sense that the people who pass through his orbit, who work for him, are the ones who in some way want to take care of him. I think some of that stems from the fact that, like, when I went from nursing to, I hung on to my nursing work as long as I could until, actually quit after my first Australian tour. I came back from the first Australian tour. I was like, okay.
Thanks, Australia.
That was good. It was like, I came back. I was like, look, I'm going to keep doing this. This looks like this is going to be the full-time job. And it was bittersweet, but at the same time, I was beginning to understand the work that I do as related, you know, as making a thing that might potentially be of value to somebody. Even if, like, when I say that, I feel weird because I don't want to say, well, yes, I make this important thing that people can have strong feelings with. It's like, not like that,
yeah.
Right?
Like, that's, you can't get the novel back on Medicare or anything like
but
that.
But no, but that's a thing, but it's also a person who makes something that's kind of funny does just as valuable a service, right? It's like you are doing some service if you make a thing that can take a person out of their present struggle and transport them even just a couple inches over to the side, right? Then that's the service that you can do. And I think about that a lot. I mean, I think there's a sense in which everybody's work is like that, viewed through the right lens, right? That anything somebody's doing is helping somebody else along for the most part. This is a matter of perspective, right? Mm. And obviously, like, you know, if I am a gravedigger, a job I have applied for recently, but they won't return my call. So, you know, probably I'm not thinking about my job in those terms, right? I'm probably not getting romantic about it because my back hurts, right? And it's very difficult physical labor. But, you know, but I think there's a sense in which, you know, the work we do in some way, if we think of how it benefits others, that's a perspective worth keeping in mind.
At some level, that's a very beneficial view of the role that creativity can play. Is the flip side possible? Is it possible that an expression of creativity in the same way that it might nudge somebody in a positive direction could do the same in a negative direction?
I don't think so. I honestly don't. I think I get really romantic and hippie about this
kind
of stuff.
That sounds very romantic, like unrealistically romantic.
No, how is it? No, it's like it's like saying, is there a food that doesn't nourish? No, it's food. Its job is to nourish, right? That's what it does, right? And creative effort, its job is to nourish also. It's I knew a guy who did free art stuff in Baltimore in the mid-90s who said, you know, art is food. You can't eat it, but it feeds you, right? And that's true. It's like, that's what it's for. Now, if you don't care for it, then it's not nutritious for you, right? Then it's useless, right? Mm. But I don't think it can suddenly become a toxin. Toxins are a different order of things. Mm.
So, but at some level, it's a match between the product and the consumer.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Those are terms I resist. But
I'm sure.
But
yeah.
But
although John is doing a signing for books that you can pay for after the after this session.
It's very, very true.
Have you come across people who have never listened to your music but read your book and really engaged with it?
I think so, but I don't really take. I haven't. It's not something. That
you don't send them to the back of the line if they haven't got your album.
You don't look like you know my stuff. You know, get behind this guy. It's like, no. I mean, the thing is, yes. I think a lot of the people who've read the book don't know my stuff otherwise, but they're not the ones who are as likely to be talking to me, right? And so I fewer of them. And I've only done so many. You know, I think I've done like 15 reading dates max, so.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a couple more minutes of me just luxuriating and enjoying asking John questions and hearing what he says, but you'll get a chance in a moment as well. There are two microphones down the front, one on this side and one on that. If you have a question and you want to make your way down, please do so now. Please, while you're waiting, contemplate how you could simplify your question, make it shorter. Not give your entire biography.
Take your time.
Take your time.
Say what you want.
Yeah,
say.
That's right.
It's
good. It's all right. No, we would love to hear from you and we want to hear your question. So if you've got a question for John, please do come down now. What are you working on at the moment and how do you see now? I mean, there are two parallel and rewarding in their own way creative careers ahead of you. You can keep writing amazing music that people will love and people respond incredibly to your novels. How do you see your creative future?
I mean, I just do stuff, right? It's like, right. There's a new album coming out. I also have another thing going on prose-wise. We'll see where it goes. But I don't see any reason not to do... This is the thing, is like, this idea of a dedicated artist, that's a fairly new idea. Mm. If you look at artists of the 16th and 17th century, scrambling to make a living, they're doing paintings, they're writing poems, they're writing plays, you know, they're writing novels as soon as the novel gets invented. And so, you know, you look at Daniel Defoe, any of these old English people writing things, often long things that we don't really read anymore because they're a little wordy, but like they're working in every field. They're drawing if they know how to draw. And so I don't really, you know.
Is that a thing for you though? Are you already contemplating?
Nothing.
No, right. Okay, so we can strike the animated novel and I mean you could do musicals, presumably.
Think about it sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I don't, because the thing is, I've gotten better at a certain type of songwriting. About like I've learned more about some ways of, like, I have a song on the next album called Luna where there's a moment where it goes from a 7 to a major 7. Never done that before on a record, right?
Nobody will notice it.
But I mean, but a 7 sounds bluesy and a major 7 sounds lush, right? But it's only a move of a half step on the fourth note of a 4-note chord, right? And I did it because I was writing the song and I had a bridge I wanted to go to and I thought, what happens if I do this? And it was just this exciting thing. And it sounds like what musicals do. Musicals have different moves that they do from pop songs as a rule, right? That you notice them even in the more rocky musicals. You hear, oh, there's the show tune part, right? And there's a bunch of tricks that I'm pretty curious. I've been listening to a lot of Godspell lately. Prepare you.
Well, if we have any people down at the front, do we have someone over here who'd like to ask a question?
John.
Devin Townsend shirt. Awesome.
Yes. First, from everyone, thank you, obviously.
Sure.
But my question is, do you still have contact with the people who formed characters like Jenny and All Hail West Texas, We Shall All Be Healed?
Well, those aren't actual people. Those are made-up people.
Okay.
So there's people who are real, for the most part, I have some... This is the thing. We live in the future. Everybody's on Facebook. So it's like, back when... You might lose track of somebody entirely, but you never do anymore. They're always hanging around in some form or another. But, you know, I haven't talked to the person who's in DeLauded since 1995, and I don't expect I probably will again. So it depends. It's case by case. But most of All Hail West Texas, those are just dreams. I don't. Those weren't people.
All right. Thanks, man.
You bet.
Thank you.
Over here.
Hey, John, thanks for coming.
Of course.
I noticed in your book you reference a lot of, like, old weird fiction, Robert E. Howard, L. Sprague de Camp, and I've sort of noticed, as I'm a fan of that, the sort of people who are into that and old school D&D are very much not normally the sort of people who listen to The Mountain Goats and would read your novel.
I don't know that that is true.
Sorry, I mistook. I was just wondering if you'd like for the book to be embraced by the sort of people who are still getting into cranky arguments about Conan and Lovecraft online.
So I play a tabletop game group every week with a game designer named Jason Morningstar, who did a game called Fiasco, and he's working on one called Night Witches that's really good. And I mean, this is the thing, is like, these days when you're starting to make art, people tell you to think about who your audience is going to be, but I just think it's so presumptuous to think about whether anybody's going to like your work at all, that I don't think too much about what kind of person would be into it, because it seems presumptuous to me. You know, it's like, my assumption is no one will ever like it. And then if somebody does, that's awesome, right? But having said that, I mean, I think, look, those games take place in the world of the imagination, although one conflict with the games that I play are really free improv, whereas D&D is very dice. You throw dice constantly in D&D. Everything you do is tethered to those dice, right? But there's a lot of other types of games you play that have no dice at all, where you're just ad-libbing moves out loud, where, you know, somebody sets the scene and says, okay, you're in Alaska, and a Russian has just shown up in town, and nobody's quite sure where he's from, but he seems a lot of... seems to have a lot of money. You work at the gas station. What do you say to him when he comes up to the counter, right? And then you just ad-lib that, right? That's a game that I played. And it's very different from D&D. It's exactly like writing songs.
So I guess this is the nerdiest question of the night, but are we going to see an Apocalypse World conversion of Trace Italia?
So no, but I totally have played Apocalypse World, which is a game by Vince. I can't think of his name. He's a total genius. What's that?
Baker?
Yeah, Vince Baker. He's a genius of game design. But no, this is the thing. I've been telling this story a lot. I think it's a good story. When I was a child, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was a movie, right? It was a great movie, although people who liked the book would often remind you that the book was better, which is also true. But anyway, they had these candies in them called Everlasting Gobstoppers, right? And they were supposed to be for poor children. You could suck them, and they'll never get any smaller. And I thought, that's magic. That's amazing. That's so, what a great idea to have a candy that you just keep. It never gets smaller. It always tastes good. That's fantastic. Well, then, when I was 8, they showed up in boxes of like 30, which is kind of weird because you only need you only need the one, right? But they were boxes of 30, and they were like 30 cents, and you buy them, and you suck it, and about 5 minutes later, you need another one because it's not the thing you read about, because books are infinite and magic, and the physical world is not, right? And so to me, to port it over to a game would be to limit a thing that is limitless within the book, right? Like, it could not be as good, right? It might be kind of fun, but that's not my style to do something like that, so.
Anyone else like to ask a question, sir?
Just a couple of questions. Have you ever thought about revisiting some of your boombox recordings with a full studio, with a full studio effort and the full band? And given our limited opportunities to see the Mountain Goats live, is there going to be a DVD at some point?
So the boombox recordings sound like I want them to sound, right? That's what those songs were made for, right? And I play them live. Live is different. But I would consider it sort of, not that the question, there's nothing wrong with the question, but for me to do that to them, I would feel like I was insulting the recording that I liked, right? To then say, well, now let me take you to this other thing. Other people look at it differently, but I like to leave them as they are. So that's not something I want to do. And also, just by nature, I always want to be moving forward. Like, if I could play shows where I only played new songs, I would do it all the time, right? I mean, people would then go, wow, I pay $30, get in this room, I hear any songs I knew. Great. Appreciate that, JD.
Read your new novel.
So, but I mean, I'm always most interested in what's new and what's next. When we want to do something like that, we put it in the set, right? And then we flesh it out live. But to spend the studio time doing that, the other thing is, like, you only get to spend so much time in the studio. It costs money. And so to be going in and revisiting old material, I think, oh, man, I'm denying myself the possibility of new work by revisiting this old thing, so it's not something I want to do. We always come back down here. We love it to pieces here. It's a little harder now that I have 2 children and Peter has 1, but I don't doubt that we'll be back to play music, of course.
We'll take another question. Can I just make one comment? We've got a bit of time. I've noticed so far, and it happens a lot at Writers' Festivals things, I think we're 100% male in our questions now, but their audience is maybe 60-40, 70-30 female, and everyone's welcome to ask a question. We want to, as 2 white Anglo-Saxon guilty-feeling males up the front here, I just think it's good to hear from everyone.
No, I agree. I'm just trying to make a grave...
Madam, thing. What would you like to ask?
Oh, I feel bad because this isn't...
Yeah,
this
fuck is you, like, man. This no, is for, no, not interested.
I feel bad about that. But this is also... This is a video game. This is a reference to... like, it looks like a metal T-shirt.
But it's not. What game is
fitting.
It?
It's a game called Dark Souls.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know about that game.
Yeah, but so obviously that's not what this question is. But when I was reading the book, and I really wanted to ask you this, as a Mountain Goats fan, I kept getting like flashes of your songs and different songs all through the book. Did you find yourself inspired by your songs while you were writing this?
No, but you're not the first person to ask that. So I mean, the thing is, like, I have, if you ever see me writing a list of something, that list is probably at least 75% of the list of my own little obsessions, like lost films. I can't get enough lost films, movies that don't exist anymore, right? And so, you know, what Mountain Goat songs are about and what's going to go in my book are going to be drawing from the same well of these. I can't call them obsessions, because a proper obsession is something you really chase down. But the sort of thing that, like, if I stop to think about it, I have a very pleasant hour musing on it and worrying it and chewing on it like a bone, you know? I wasn't consciously doing that. That just means you're seeing inside my brain.
I must say, it was something that I found when I was reading it, that anytime you describe one of your characters hearing music and being particularly affected by music, you think, hang on, is this something that, you know, is really telling for a musician who's now writing a novel? Is that something that you were aware of? Did you see yourself tending to interpret things through music?
Well, I mean, I think when I'm writing about music, I'm writing about stuff that I would like to imagine hearing, and especially stuff that I don't think, like, when I describe a music that doesn't exist, I like to be trying to describe something that I don't think I know anything that sounds exactly like that. Instead of trying to describe something I know, you know, when he describes the Conan tapes he gets, it's like, I don't have anything that sounds exactly like that. So it's imaginary. And to me, like, that's my favorite stuff, the stuff that can't quite exist.
Thank you for your question. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. And ladies and gentlemen, please thank John Darnielle for his music, for his work, and for being here tonight.
Thank you
very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Julian Morrow there, in conversation with John Darnielle, and the talk was recorded at a Sydney Writers' Festival event in February last year. We can say that now. John Darnielle was talking about his debut novel, Wolf in White Van, published in Australia by Scribe. I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is Best of the Festivals. To take us to the news, some music from John's band, The Mountain Goats. The name of the song is rather timely. It's called This Year.
Through this year, if it kills me.